Hey everyone, my name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy, where I do interviews with real tech entrepreneurs for an audience of real tech entrepreneurs. Like, frankly, today's guest, both a listener and now an interviewee. And frankly, if I discovered him on my own, I don't know if I would have had him on Mixergy. Because who knew that this was such a big business, frankly? The truth is that a few months ago, a guy named Chad McAllister, who's been listening for a long time, sent me an email about this guy, Latif. He said, Andrew, he'd be a great person to invite over for Scotch or to have on Mixergy as a guest. And he started telling me about this Latif's business, and I thought, huh, really? So then I looked him up on Product Hunt, and man, people were beating up on the product, beating up on him. How could you charge so much? God knows, $25 a person. How dare you? And again, wasn't really sure what to make of him. And then our producer talked to Latif, the founder you're about to meet, found out about the business. It's just growing and growing for a company that's just been around for just a few years and has got an innovative idea and a product that you never would have, in an area you never would have thought could support a product. Really impressive business. All right, I want to introduce you to him and find out how he built up his company. His name is Latif Nanji. He is the founder of Roadmunk. Roadmunk helps companies create and share their product strategy and roadmaps. We'll talk more later about what that means. First, I've got to tell you that this interview is sponsored by the company that will help you hire your next great developer. It's called TopTal, and by the company that will help you do email marketing right. Really, automate your marketing. It's called ActiveCampaign, but I'll tell you more about those later. First, Latif, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Hey, before I get into this whole Roadmunk thing, you, before you did this, when you were 21 years old, you ran something called Poker Space. What's Poker Space?
Poker Space was a social network for poker players. So when Facebook was in its hype and taking off, we leveraged sort of the social networking rocket ship that was going off and combined it with poker players, as I had played poker for the previous 3 years online and had done fairly well, but wanted to, instead of making my schedule go to 5 a.m. in the morning, maybe ended at 5 p.m. sort of on a regular cadence. So that was sort of the onset to the entrepreneurial career in the tech industry.
And to help you figure out how to grow this business, you went to your neighbor's house often. Why?
So we were in an incubator that was really new in the Waterloo
ecosystem. You were in an incubator?
Yeah.
Okay. In an incubator. With the poker site? With Poker Space?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. And so what happened?
So we had raised, $1.5 million and did a lot of the learnings there, but next door to us was a company called Maya Vision, and they were also on a very similar trajectory. And during my time at Poker Space, we sort of five best friends had started this up, and we had realized that we had a lot to learn during our time building a social network. We had over 100,000 members. We were doing millions in revenue, but at the same time, we were growing a business as sort of young entrepreneurs.
And what was it actually? How did you make millions of dollars from this Facebook for poker players?
So our revenue model is actually fairly simple. So what we would do with the poker sites is we would negotiate a revenue share agreement, or what's called a CPA, a cost per acquisition. Mm-hmm. And so each player could be worth anywhere between $300 to $500 on a one-time basis. But since there was a dozen to 20 different poker sites, the LTV of a particular user could be upwards of $5,000. And when you've got 100,000 of those, you can start to really monetize them very quickly.
You also had Poker School, I think, right? Were you guys charging for that?
We did have an education system and component as well that we did charge for. It was sort of a smaller part of the business because most of the money was made between sending those players, getting them better at poker, and then sending them to the websites, because the longer they played, the more that we made.
I see. And then what's this thing where you also said on your website at one point, over $50,000 paid out every month to whom?
Oh, wow.
So yeah, why did the
the commissions. So we had affiliates. So this was basically a massive affiliate engine. And so there was another layer of middlemen where people were sending us players from their websites. And so people that sent us poker players, we would then buy them from them and we would send them an affiliate check. So there was a lot of money to be made on both sides of the equation.
So people were sending you players, you were giving them commission. You were getting those players to stay on your site and socialize more, and then recommending that they play on different poker sites, and also telling them about different tournaments on different poker sites, all to keep them playing there longer, because the longer they play on those sites, the bigger your commissions are. And you also had a school on the side. The school wasn't bringing in as much revenue as sending people to the actual poker sites, but it was there too.
That's exactly right.
Got it. I got the model. And then when you were going next door to your next door neighbor's house, what were you learning from them?
Well, we were learning pretty much everything that I think entrepreneurs think is 101. So how to build a team and a culture, scale management, what software tools to even track all of the things that build software. We were at the very beginnings of that. But I learned a lot about product management, especially from the early founders, because they were both building hardware and software. And so that team alignment component became really big. We also had our early founder issues because we were five really good friends that built this company together. So we also had to deal with those kinds of challenges. And that was a great learning experience as well when I was pretty young.
All right. This poker site is no longer around. What happened to it?
So as most startups happen, we ran out of money. And it was
why? You were making so much money from commissions. Is it because all the poker sites started to go out of business and they stopped paying?
So that was the other side of it. Yeah. So there was something called Black Friday that happened. And there was a law that was passed called the UIGEA law. And the Unlawful Internet Gaming and Enforcement Act was pushed through the United States Congress. And what that meant was is that they wanted to control all the transactions for taxing purposes. So a lot of the smaller sites started to dwindle. There's a lot of players that stopped playing. And a lot of the sites couldn't even pay us out. So there was a big, we didn't end up getting paid out from these websites. So there was obviously that friction that came into play. So with the laws, the lack of, and the scandal that had happened since a lot of players got duped out of a bunch of money, we were right in the middle of that because if they can't pay the players, they obviously couldn't pay us. And so the cash reserves kind of started to lower because we couldn't pull in our incoming AR.
Give me the human interest out of this, right? At the height, you were making money, boatloads of cash. And at the low, you were sad. give me an example of the height. What's the greatest like baller move that you did?
In an actual poker tournament, you mean?
No, even in life. Did you buy yourself a great car? Did you start dressing kind of fancy? Did you do something else?
Oh, wow, yeah. So for me, the biggest kind of move that I did was when I had won a big tournament once online. It was for a decent amount. It was for around $50,000 or $60,000. I took out half the cash, and I was young. I wanted to buy a house, and there was a new build, so I just went right up to them. And I was like, I want to just buy and just put a down payment for like a decent amount in cash. And I just bought the house and I moved in within like 3 or 4 months. And this was crazy because I also didn't have poker school debt. So, you know, in Canada, it's a little bit less, but I was able to, by the age of 20, basically cut off my and be like, hey, I'm good. Thank you. And then paid off all my school debt. And it was mostly the trips with the friends that I had covered through the Bahamas, Aruba,
Las Vegas. You would pay for all your friends to come to the Bahamas. I see. Okay.
Yeah. So a lot of those kinds of trips were
posh luxury trips.
Yeah, they were pretty expensive.
Like, what do you get when you have money to spend on a trip?
When you're 21, I mean, you don't necessarily have the grandest taste, but really it's coming down to the hotel room, spending it at the casino, tons of bottle service and things like that.
Okay. Black Friday comes. Company starts to lose money. Yep. Take me to the low. Again, the human interest side. What happened at that point to you?
Well, what was crazy is that, so the investors, you have to keep in mind, since you're in the middle of the house of cards, were also losing money because the 08 crash was happening at the exact same time.
Ah, right. So they were suffering too.
This was like October, like August, September, October of 2008. So they were coming to us saying, you should sell the company. We had a potential buyer, but there was a liquidation preference that made it unfavorable for them. So now we're combating with investors, we're combating with black market, and we're running out of money. So we're getting hit with from sort of three different angles, none of which we've ever fielded off before. And so this kind of culminating in us having to downsize because we really didn't know what our recourse was at that point.
You close out the company?
No, we went down to about three employees from about 20. And I was not one of the three, so I moved on to my next opportunity.
Was it frustrating that you got fired, or did it actually feel like a relief? Finally, I'm done with this. Now it's their headache.
You know what? There was this moment of like, man, like this is crazy that this isn't working, and we put so much effort into it, and I'd spent a lot of my own personal resources into the company, as well as my co-founders. But there was this moment where I recognized that was the definition of failure. And I was so overwhelmed with joy that I'm like, if this is what failure is, it's really not that bad.
Right.
Now, mind you, I was 22, 23 coming out of it. I had a whole runway of opportunities in front of me. I had gathered a whole set of skills because I became a voracious reader, which I wasn't prior to the startup.
Right.
Because I had a lot of ideas about how I thought the world should be and intuitively, but I didn't have the language and articulation, and started reading Richard Branson's books. I'm reading books from Dan Heath and the guys from Harvard. And all of a sudden, I was able to start to form myself into this new person from that. And I realized I was actually very grateful for that experience more than anything.
Okay. And so did you lose your house, by the way?
No, I still have that.
You still have the house? Okay. All right. And the house, or the neighbors that you had at the time were MioVision. That's a company we were talking about. You ended up working for them.
Yeah. So after Poker Space sort of died off or trimmed off there, I ended up going to work for them. They obviously were very interested since we had talked for a couple of years. And they were going from, 15 to 100 people over the next 36 months. And so I got to join them as a product manager and take on some of the major initiatives that they had going on there.
And the CEO, Curtis McBride, comes to you one day and says, "Hey, Latif, what are we going to be doing over the next year with this product?" And
yes.
Your response was?
"We're doing Agile. I can tell you what we're doing over the next 2 weeks." And let me tell you, that wasn't the answer he was looking for. He wanted to know to his board what we're doing for the next year, what the market strategy was, what the product strategy was. And we just simply didn't have a handle on that, because we were just really focused on the day-to-day with respect to building out the product for the current customer base.
Isn't that the right way to approach things? I could see that they work in here. Here's how TechCrunch describes what they do. They develop intelligent technology solutions to address the challenges facing today's global transportation network and to minimize environmental impact of inefficient transportation flow. So they're in software for transportation, right? I get how they might need a little bit longer roadmap, but isn't it better to be more agile, to see what customers want week to week, to produce a product and then decide where you're going to go after people react to that product?
Absolutely. And I don't think there's actually a conflict between agile and road mapping, whether it's short, medium, or long-term road mapping. In fact, we just put out an ebook about that. And the reason we did that is because I think people just intuitively feel that they cannot coexist. But the reality is that if you want to do budgeting, if you want to do long-term hiring, because it does take a while to find key hires, if you do want to go into a market that's much greater, you have to do some level of planning. And it doesn't necessarily need to be regimented on a specific date, but it does have to have a forward direction. And I think that's the main purpose of why we had to undergo this exercise. Granted, they do have hardware, which does actually require, inventory controls and long-term road mapping. So there has to be a balance between 2 week sprints as well as 6 month planning.
I see. And he said, "All right, you guys are good at the 2 week sprint stuff. Thanks for being so agile. Mm-hmm. But I need to know where we're going to be half a year from now. Create a way for me to do it." And so you guys start to build this process, the software internally just for yourselves. Can I ask you a dumb question?
Mm.
Why not just use Excel? Why not just say, you know what, we're going to create rows with all the things we need to do and columns with the dates, and we'll hit cross marks or hash marks in the cells representing when things are due. You're smiling. Does that seem like the first version that you built?
That's absolutely what we did. That is not a dumb question. That's how actually mostly about 98% of the market uses and creates roadmaps today, is in Excel and PowerPoint. What we didn't know, though, is that there was an element of collaboration. There was an element of buy-in. When sales goes out into the field, there's organizations that literally all their sales reps have specific roadmaps for those particular customers. So there were different variances of that that required more energy. In this particular organization, they needed some collaboration. They needed to have some customer input, but it wasn't much more bigger than that. But when we presented what we were doing and where this tool could go to an audience of product managers, there was a few enterprise product managers in the room that just overtly stated, "We would buy that software today from you, because going between Excel and PowerPoint, a tabular format and a visual format back and forth, spends an extraordinary amount of time, and it chews up product managers' strategy time that they could be using for something else."
And the reason they were going back and forth is Excel is where they would create the product roadmap, and then they would export it into Excel, into PowerPoint, so they could present it to their customers, so they could present it internally to the team and say, "Here's where we're going. Don't worry. I know you're looking for this feature. Here's how it fits in with what we're building."
Exactly.
I see. Okay. So they were going back and forth. This whole interviews, how did you go from "My CEO needs something"? Excuse me. I think I said earlier that Curtis was a COO. He's a CEO or was. How did you go from building it for him, for Curtis, to suddenly starting to have conversations with people outside the company?
So I was really connected to the product management peer-to-peer community in Waterloo. They have these round tables in which all the salespeople can sit together, all the product managers can sit together. So I was still early on in my product management career, so I was always coming up with these ideas of how to move the needle forward. And so one of the presentations I had done there was all the tools that product managers need. And I had this big open space with road mapping where I said Excel, PowerPoint, Microsoft Project, Visio, and then I talked about our internal tool. And so that was sort of the bridge between our sort of internal focus where I'm heads down to opening my eyes and seeing that there's a market of other people that do things differently in their organizations.
You know what? This is kind of an interesting thing. I remember one of my conversations with Tim Ferriss around interviewing ended with him saying, okay, I got what I was looking for. By the way, what software are you using? And I started telling him, he said, can I see that? Or actually, I think he expressed such an interest. I said, do you want to see this? And I said, here's a link where I can show you my screen. We got on Zoom and I started sharing my screen with him. And he started asking all these questions. How do you book guests? What do you do this? What do you have? And he wanted to see the software. And until he started asking these questions in the way that he asked it, I didn't realize the importance of understanding the software that other people use. You guys, you seem to have gotten benefit from that back when you were just next door to the guys from MioVision, right? What is it about this group meeting that you were just telling me about where you're sharing software and you're saying, here's how we're using these tools? What is it about the sharing that's useful?
For us, you know, I think it comes down to one of our core values, which is empathy. The ability to go into someone's psychology and mindset and like live and breathe their problems every day. There's simply nothing that can replace that. It's still why we go get on a plane and visit a customer. And so when someone's like, I need to see how you solve this problem, well, we can talk about it in words, but if we go through all the nitty gritty of how you set up a roadmap, where do you, how do you set up the structures? How do you present it? People were like, so how do you go through that step-by-step process, just like you did with Tim, who I'm a very huge fan of, by the way. There's something to be said about that because all of those subtleties really make up the experience of the product. There's a reason why Slack won, even though it had all these competitors already doing what they did. It's because they figured out these subtleties that made the workflow so concise and usable, which is why they spent 2 or 3 years in sort of a beta inside of an organization learning all those problems. And I think that is why successful companies exist, is because they're building products with that in mind.
I think I'm hearing two things, Latif. One is, you went to a group of product managers and you said, here's the tools that we're using internally so they could learn from you. And then you also, and then they got excited about this product roadmap, the software that you were building. Am I right? And then
yes.
The second thing is, you then said, I want to go and understand how other people have this problem and how they solve it. And you started doing one-on-one meetings. In fact, you said to our producer, I had 150 coffees, 150 conversations with different product managers to understand this problem. Tell you what, let me take a moment and then we're going to come back and find out how you had those conversations and what you got from them. But the first thing I want to tell anyone who's listening to me is that, if you've been doing email where you're just broadcasting email out to everyone, you're making a big mistake. The solution to email, to reaching your audience, isn't one big broadcast to every single person. What we learned over the last 5 years as marketers is you want software that will allow you to treat customers different from non-customers, but more than that. If somebody's on your website, in fact, for you, Latif, imagine you have someone who's reading an article about product roadmaps for startups, and another person who's reading an article about how enterprise can incorporate product roadmap software into their businesses. You now know that these are two different kinds of people. You don't want to send them the same email. For the startup, you might want to say, here's how it helps you stay flexible. For enterprise, you might want to start telling them, here's how it allows you to communicate with a big team. The only way you can keep track of who's whom is by having software that intelligently knows who your audience is based on what they're doing, not what they're telling you. You don't need endless surveys. Just what pages are they on? What are they clicking in the emails you send them? And based on that, you start to change your messaging to them. So you have different sets of email based on who people are, and the software knows who gets what. That's the idea behind marketing automation. Now, this is very basic stuff, what I just described to you. You can have tons of if-then statements. If they click today and tomorrow and the next day and the day after that, maybe they're clicking so much that you might want to have a customer talk to a salesperson. So maybe you trigger, if they click every email for the last 7 days, you trigger an email that says, we're offering demos on Monday. Here's a link with our calendar. Book whatever time works for you. If they're not clicking anything, maybe they're not engaged enough and you might want to change your content. Maybe you want to throw something in that's a little more social, a little more fun to bring their attention back. All those things are what marketing automation is all about. If you want to see how it could work for you guys, go check out this link, activecampaign.com/MixerG. What I like about that is there is a screenshot right in the middle of the page showing you, basically in one visual, how marketing automation can work for you with a potential customer. And as you scroll through it, you're going to see how it will ActiveCampaign will allow you to keep tabs on who your customers are, what their phone numbers are, what their interests are, what they've done, what they bought, what notes your other team members have left on them, and how the software will automate the way that you engage with them. Special URL that will also, the one that I just gave you, will allow you to have your second month free. Let you have two free one-on-one sessions with their platform consultants, so you'll have an expert walk you through how you can really take advantage of all the features of marketing automation, not just have them be there and you never use them. And finally, if you're on one of the more basic email packages or even a competitor to ActiveCampaign and you want to migrate, they will offer you free migration. But all this will come to you if you just use a simple URL. It is activecampaign.com/MixerG, activecampaign.com/MixerG. And I know from the feedback I've gotten via email that this is one of the most used sponsor products. So I'm grateful to them for sponsoring because people are being helped by it. Their businesses are growing. Thank you, activecampaign.com/MixerG. Hey, how did you get, Latif, 150 conversations with product managers?
It was a hustle. It was as simple as that. I had to email every person that I knew that knew a product manager. I would reach out on LinkedIn. I found people within the community that were thought leaders. I was still fairly young, and I recognized that I had a lot to learn in the space, so I wanted to make sure I took in everyone's information so that I could use it to build the best product. But those coffees were invaluable because, one, what I didn't realize is that all of these people actually wanted to help because I was going to be making their lives easier. In return for them giving me information, I was going to build them something that they could use in the future. So all of them would be part of their early experience. They could shape some of the product. So over the course of around 4 months is when I was heads down doing this and my technical co-founder
four
was...
4 months. By the way, you still had a job at the time?
Oh, no. This is when we had started the startup. This
I see. So like, you said, look, I see there's enough of a problem here that yes. I got to go for it. I've got to leave my job. I have to focus on this full time. And focus for me means at first talking to lots of people. Let me break down for a second your process. You said it was easy to get people on the phone with you, get them to in-person in-person conversations. What was the messaging? What's the phrase that you said that got people to say, yes, Latif, I don't know who you are. Let's get together because I need you.
So the one of the things that I think we did that was fairly unique with respect to getting them to have an in-person conversation was that they were going to be able to help build the product from its early onset. I'm solving a problem for you guys that I've heard you've had in this domain.
How did you express the problem in a way that let them say, aha, he does get it?
I think it was what I would do since they were part of the early peer group, if they had made any mention of their particular problem, so they would say, oh, our road mapping process is done this way and this is our problem, I would speak directly to that point in the email. So I would take notes on those people. And then since I'd have social proof with them, it would be very easy to leverage that first concentric circle of peers to then go to the next one.
I see. So I helped Steve at XYZ company. You know who he is. Can I talk to you too?
Yeah.
Got it. And you had those peer group from where? How did you get so many people?
So Communitech is an organization in KW. They've been around for over 15 years, started by the guys over at OpenText, people like Carol Lehman, Ian Klugman, and a lot of the major founders in the KW community of Kitchener-Waterloo, excuse me.
Hang on, let me pause a second for that because I asked you before the interview started, what's the one thing I could do for you in this interview? And I thought you'd say, hey, Andrew, we'd like to get more users. Hey, Andrew, we'd like to hire. You said, no, I want you to talk about Waterloo. I'd like you to talk about Toronto. Why does this matter so much? And I guess I'm seeing it here because Communitech, this organization that's from that part of the world, is what helped get you going.
Absolutely. There's no more direct correlation between, I think, a lot of the founders who are becoming successful or are successful than what Communitech has done. Communitech is a nonprofit organization that helps over 1,000 local tech companies build, help finance, and give advice to those startups. And they do it in the most constructive and streamlined process. to be a CommuniTech member is free for startups, or it's like less than $1,000 going forward. And they give you access to a database of incredible information. But not only that, they're proactive. They're not reactive. It says, don't come to us when you need help. We're going to come to you because we think you need this, because we understand what the cycle of a startup is, and here's how we can help. And then when they have their own buildings with those resources actually stationed there every single day. I mean, this is an environment that you have the greatest chance of success. And they do it in such a way that I think that's different from down south, where it's more hyper-competitive, everyone's stealing from each other. In Canada, it's much more fostered with, like, how can we help each other? And CommuniTech has been the entire glue of the tech ecosystem on the East Coast.
I see. I'm looking at their website right now. They'll do legal briefs, one-on-one guidance with qualified lawyers at no cost. They'll do things like Google for Entrepreneurs, where they're part of an organization with Google, which means you're going to get free startup resources, invited to pitch contests and co-working space at home and abroad. I see. All right. So that is what got you your first group of product managers. That's who you were going after, right?
Yeah. And they run all of the peer-to-peer groups for every type of job category. So you could be a CEO, a COO, a VP of finance, a product manager, et cetera. They have peer groups led by the top, you know, VP of finance, who organizes and does that and brings those people together for best practices. So it proliferates throughout the entire set of tech companies.
I see. Okay. And you know what? Let me just underline something before I ask your next question. You talked to 150 people. I think most entrepreneurs in your position wouldn't even send out 150 requests, mm-hmm. let alone end up with 150 conversations. I think it's so easy to send out 15 and go, this is BS. It's not going to work out. Latif is lying. It's BS. Someone's exaggerating somewhere and get cynical. But man, to actually do the work and send out 150, even 100 offers for people to get together with you and give you feedback and help solve their problem is impressive. What did you learn from that you didn't know, having done this for so long and built it? What's one piece of knowledge that you got that helped inform the product?
So everyone does road mapping differently. If you go to a pharmaceutical company, there's no concept of agile with the life cycle of a 20-year drug. That doesn't even exist in that world. If you go to the military space, they're dealing with 50-year roadmaps. You go to aerospace, they're dealing with 25 and 30-year roadmaps. If you're dealing with software startups, yes, you might get the 3 month to 1 year, but then you've got organizations that if they have hardware, they have a whole different way of doing road mapping. And so all of a sudden, we had to take all of the different roadmap templates from all these product managers, and then we created a Canvas board between my co-founder and I. And what we tried to do is we tried to pull out the common elements from each of these roadmaps to create our first version, so that we could, you know, say if we looked at about 15 different more verticals, we could probably tackle the first five based on the common elements and then work our way there. So it helped us, A, figure out the shape of the market, B, it set our priorities, and C, it gave us a governance structure to actually building what was going to sell early on so that we could be sustainable.
Why not say we're going to focus on one of these groups? Pharmaceutical companies, you told our producer, do 20-year roadmaps. Let's just focus on pharmaceutical companies first, and then we'll start to add features for other people.
So we did do that, but what we recognize is that there's still a decent overlap between the two, and the best thing that we could do to service that market is get that information and then have customer success go in and continue to work with them. But we had enough where we could start to sell. So our first customer was in the medical space, and so their medical roadmaps are running 2 to 3 years. And then we started selling into software. Then we got a huge pharmaceutical company, and then we started to go around doing that. But we could focus on one market, but then we would really have to have an outbound sales market model. And we wanted to have an inbound model. So if we could service a more generic slice of the market, we could then get in leads that could then automate their way through the payment process, which is what we wanted to do for our customer journey.
I see. Okay. All right. And one of the things you told the producer you did was you started, when you were talking to people, asking them for a non-sensitive template of their roadmap. So you can actually have a copy of what they use to run their product development. And you also said, look, the one thing that got us going that said, okay, we're ready to roll, is a conversation with Andre from a big healthcare company. What did Andre say? What's the phrase that got you guys started?
Andre said, I'll pay you a lot of money for that.
I see. Like, you finally described something that he said, I'm willing to put down cash for. What was it that he said, I'm willing to pay for that?
He said he looked at the ability to take a tabular view of his releases and what he was roadmapping to visually being able to go into his boardroom at a $100 million plus company, revenue company, and be able to present that with confidence and work with a global team structure. So he has three offices, two in North America and one in Switzerland. The challenge is that if they're in PowerPoint and they're using SharePoint, there's all these documents exchanging hands. They're not in the cloud. They're not collaborative. They don't have a way to track history of what's going on very easily. And everyone gets lost in the mud. And so when he saw that there was actually a way to do this as a SaaS offering that would save him money and time and look better because we were focused on building this product going forward, which is an incredibly huge thing when you're replacing an internal tool, that just became so obvious as a pain point for him to drop, you know, upwards of close to six figures on a product like this.
Six figures?
Yes.
For cloud-based software?
Yes.
Ah, and now you have your first, did you collect payment or did you?
This was 2 years ago, so we're past
2014. That. Did you collect payment first from him or did you go build it and then charge him?
So we did we actually built it. And then when we did our first version launch, we took 50% then. And then we did a 6 month beta with his users, ironed out all of the kinks. And then we took the remaining 50% after that.
You told our producer in 3 months we got, do you remember how many customers?
I do remember.
How many?
It was 50.
50. How do you get 50 customers to pay you for a product that basically is an alternative to what they're already doing, right? You can't get people to switch from spreadsheets for like their contact list to a CRM sometimes. How do you get 50 people to do that in 3 months?
I honestly think my laughter is because it still surprises me to this day, just the tone of the question, because we had no idea how many people were going to pay for this. We set up Stripe, we set up a billing system, and we just said, here's a pricing model that was mostly untested. Let's be honest here. Yeah, we had some conversations, but there was just some word of mouth that was spreading in the early part of the chasm with the product innovators. And something had clicked and they realized that when you searched online product roadmap and you searched those particular keywords, there was one or two offerings. And we spent an inordinate amount of time on design. We're sort of a very much design focused firm. We've even implemented a design system. We've got five designers that spread across the organization because we care so much about the experience of the user that we wanted to make sure that even if it was buggy, even if it didn't have all the features, you felt a sense of trust coming into this tool and that it would soon allow you to do what it needed to. And so that was one of our core things we did when we launched. And I think that had a big part to play in those early customers onboarding.
I see. All right. And there was actually revenue coming in the door for a bootstrap company. Life is starting to actually get good, mm-hmm. right?
Yes.
And you go from two people. It's you and your co-founder. Who is your co-founder?
My co-founder's name is Thomas Benda, so he was the head of engineering at MyoVision, and he's worked in four different startups, so he was quite ready for this opportunity.
How'd you get him to leave, and what was it about this opportunity that got him ready?
I think it was a conversation over a couple glasses of scotch and beer, but the real trigger was when we filled out a YC application in 2012 on what was called the No Idea Stream. We got an interview there, and sitting down in that particular environment was a very good validation, I think, for not just myself, but mostly for him to be like, this could be very real. I think we have the team, potentially an idea in front of us. And so that was sort of the onset moment.
All right. I've got to tell people about a company called TopTal. Have you heard about them before, Mixergy? You know them. I'll tell you about them, Latif.
Yes.
Here's the thing. I actually read a book. You're a big reader. Did you know about the book called The Firm about McKinsey, the consulting company?
I've heard of it, but I haven't read it.
It's kind of like a biography of McKinsey. And this is a firm that's had like incredible alumni who've gone through it and been a part of the McKinsey consulting company. What's interesting about them is that McKinsey would go in and solve a problem for one company. And then what they would do is they'd get smarter. So when they went to address a problem of another company, they'd be that much more intelligent because they saw a problem at another big company. And each new business that these consultants would go work for would lead them to be smarter because they solved so many problems in other businesses. And, you know, you've got people like I'm trying to think of some of their alumni. And for some reason, there's just so many here on the Wikipedia page, no one's standing out for me. They're just all names. Actually, for some reason, I don't even recognize them. But they're big people who've come out of that, who've run major companies, major government agencies, from McKinsey. Anyway, the reason I'm bringing it up in regard to TopTal is when we usually hire developers, we hire one person who's had two different company experience with two or three different companies, who's now coming into our company and bringing in experience from those two companies. And it's good. But what we often need is a lot more experience, someone who's solved multiple problems. And that's one of the benefits of working with TopTal. These guys, and I've said before, they will put a lot of tests in the way of every potential TopTal developer. You know, you can't get into the TopTal network unless you've gone through all these different tests. But once you're in, you solve so many different companies' problems that you just become a better developer. And you also have access to all these other people who are also in the TopTal network, you know, the best of the best, who are talking to each other on a regular basis using Slack, using the other developers as sounding boards. So if there's an issue that they can't solve, they don't have to go on to just Stack Exchange. They could just go into this network of people who are all knowing each other, who all support each other. Some of them are in the same city, and say, here's the problem. How do you solve it? Here's the issue. Here's what my client is looking to do. We haven't come up with a great way to do it. How would you do it? And so that's the benefit of working with TopTal. If you're looking for a great developer, you owe it to yourself to at least have a conversation with TopTal. And I say a conversation because even though I'm going to give you a URL to a web page, one of the first things they'll do with you is just talk to you. And many people have complained to me that TopTal actually says, no, you're not a good fit. I think that's actually not something to complain about. That's good. If you call TopTal and they say, hey, you're not a good fit because you're not far enough along with your business, or they can't solve the problems that you want them to address, they should say no. They shouldn't take every single customer. So if you want to see if you're a good fit, and if you are, you'll get to work with these developers from TopTal. Here's a URL where they will give you 80 hours of TopTal developer credit when you pay for your first 80 hours. And that's in addition to a no-risk trial period of up to 2 weeks. That's an incredible offer available only at toptal.com/Mixergy. That's TOPTAL.com/Mixergy. Top is in top of the mountain. Tal is in talent.com/Mixergy. Great company. I see you now have your partner, you now have your customers, and then you told our producer, we had to scale up. We had to bring in more people. One of the biggest pain points was customer support and engineering. Talk to me a little bit about what happens when you get that many customers all at once who depend on you for their product development.
Yeah, that was definitely a challenge for us. We did have to do a fundraise. I think that was really imminent because we had customers like Nike, Citibank, Amazon, Coca-Cola coming at us with obviously really big needs. And you have a decision as a company to make whether you choose to service the enterprise and above the SMB market, or you go sort of to the tail end. And we decided we wanted to be aggressive and pursue that. And so we had to scale up. Now, thankfully, we have a remote culture here. So we have our development office next to the University of Waterloo in Kitchener. And we have our operations team in Toronto. So we had to go aggressively higher, going from about 6 people to 30 in 2016.
People to 30 people. You have to hire that many in what? In about a year?
Yeah, in a year.
So you raised what? $1.6 million? Do I have that right?
Yeah, around there.
From Golden Venture Partners?
Golden Venture Partners, Felicis, and Garage VC.
I see. Okay. And so how do you hire that many people all at once without ending up with bozos?
So the first thing and the most important weapon you need, and this is something that I have to say I read on a Mark Suster post because it was really informative, was like, as soon as you close that round, the first hire you make is an office manager and a recruiter. And it's not the key developer that you need right away, or that product manager or that marketing guru. We went in and hired an office manager that worked both at Twitter and 500pixels, so two very very famous companies in the Toronto ecosystem, and as well Twitter globally. We brought her on, and she came a force within the organization, and so she set the hiring pipeline and actually was the key driver to making sure that we scaled and got the right people in place.
I see. And when you get a recruiter on board, it's interesting that that's one of the first people. We're talking about kind of a temporary recruiter, right? This isn't the full-time position, is it?
Well, we kind of got a unicorn in this case because she was both an office manager and knew how to recruit. So when responsibilities needed to shift in terms of direction, she could handle one and the other at the same time, because we knew that we were going to be continuously scaling, and today we still are.
So you can actually get someone who's going to do office management work, which is like, our bathroom's not working, or we need to get a better computer for our team, and at the same time recruit?
She was doing both of those jobs. Today we do have someone else that's sort of offloaded the office managerial job that we just hired a few months ago. But for the first year, she was definitely doing both of those responsibilities, and we're very grateful for that.
Interesting. I have I rent a garage here in San Francisco. I want to have a place where we can keep our car. It's just like attached to our place, to our house. From a guy who's a recruiter who on a regular basis will switch positions and just go in as like a recruiter for hire for some of the major tech firms here. And I could tell who is about to go through a growth spurt based on where he's working. Actually, that would be an interesting way to keep tabs on companies to see who just brought in a new recruiter. I don't know how you would find that though. Who brought in one of these recruiter for hires?
Little LinkedIn, figure out their job title through the
Yeah, I wonder if paper. if they list it. They seem to be a lot stealthier than you'd expect. All right, I see it. How did you learn how to hire? Because even though you're hiring a recruiter, you still need to learn how to bring people in. What's the book or what's the methodology that you used?
So one of the things that we did is the very first day we started this company, and it was actually a piece of advice Curtis had given us, is that get your company values down right from day one. And we spent, I think, the whole day trying to figure out how to do this. And then over time, we nailed down our four company values around empathy, learning and growth, balance, and being relentlessly resourceful. So with those four values in mind, we hired against them. And our biggest one is empathy. So do they have empathy for the user? Are they willing to jump on support at any time? Do they have an emotional intelligence that matches that of being capable to work in very difficult startup situations? And, you know, when you have a very smart person that could be, you know, has a high aptitude for just general intelligence, do they still match balance in life? Do they still make sure that they do the things that we think are respecting both their personal and their business life so they can have a healthy life? So those are the types of qualitative things we try to suss out in our interview process, and we became way more regimented over time. So if someone didn't fit those values that we had, we simply couldn't hire them because then they wouldn't fit the culture.
And you just sat down with like a Google Doc a whole day and you said, let's make a bullet point list of everything we care about.
Let's just talk and see what comes up. And that was, I mean, you just have to go through that creative exercise.
I see. Okay. Who's Noah Weiss, or is it Wise? Noah Wise?
Noah Wise. He is our first customer success manager, and he's based out of our London office.
London. What does it mean to be a customer success? What is it called? A customer success officer?
Manager, yes.
Manager. What does that mean?
So traditionally in SaaS or a company sort of pre-5 years ago, there was customer support and there was account management and then there's sales. And to a certain degree, that exists very much today. What we recognize, since we had a demand generation model where all of our leads come inbound, we need someone that's going to be able to help them from the support level, that's going to help them close a deal and be able to take their account to onboard, you know, 10, 20, 50 product managers, and own that whole cycle for certain deal sizes under a certain threshold. And a lot of the times in traditional, it's a handoff. You have a customer success person who's just handling tickets. Then you got someone who's going in through the procurement cycle, and then you hand it off to an account manager. We wanted someone that was what we call a full stack customer success agent. And a full stack person has those skills to do all of those things. And so we've hired to build our business around customer success. What is it that the user has at each journey? And can one person touch all of those points? So they're always dealing with the same person. And that makes their experience as a customer so much more delightful, and they're more likely to buy with us. In fact, that's how we won the New York Times as one of our big premier customers, through that experience. And I think that really speaks volumes for the way the team is structured here.
You know, speaking of a team, you grow that fast. One of the issues is, how do you communicate with everyone, right?
Yeah, that's a...
Talk to me about how that's a problem first. Like, what's an example of bad team communication? I keep reading about how Slack wants to solve that people can't find stuff inside a company and they waste, I don't know, they always have the stats of how many hours they waste. It's like 20 days a year wasted just trying to find stuff within an organization. It is a problem. You've told our producer, what is it for you guys? How did it express itself?
Well, I think communication is sort of the fundamental core, because they need to learn something. You're asking a question, or you've not been told something because you weren't aligned on it. It's based to do with knowledge at the end of the day. Slack is a great tool, but if you're a new employee, where are you going to go read what's happened in the last year? Like, how are you going to catch up?
Right.
And if any scaling organization, if you think about it, probably like in our case, a third of the people started in the last 6 months, which means a third of the people are still onboarding, which means a third of the people are most likely to still be not in alignment with the rest of the organization. And 6 months from now, another quarter of the people in the organization. So you've got this cascading effect where nobody is ever aligned as the company grows. That's a huge problem. And I don't necessarily believe that we've solved it the best. One of the things that we have done, though, to combat this, and this really works well for us, is each team has a series of lunch and learns that they do every biweekly. So a person picks a topic in the organization that they've seen, that they've learned, and they present that to the entire company or to that particular group of people that are interested in that topic. And so the development teams and engineering teams are very well known for doing this in organizations, but operational teams are not.
I see.
And so sales and marketing and our product team and a design team all go through those exercises so that knowledge is transferred, and then we document it, and then we take all of that information, we put it into our onboarding document. And so there's this upfront knowledge that kind of gets like swooped in like a snowball growing. And then we take that snowball and we front load it into our onboarding documentation, and then we put that there.
How do you keep the onboarding documentation from being out of date or flooded with too much content?
It's really a parsing exercise and filtering. It's an iterative process, to be honest. There's no silver bullet there. I think it's just recognizing what's important, understanding our management techniques, understanding our culture, understanding what's happened in the last year. So one simple thing we do is we take a couple of the company meeting slides, we distill that down, and we put that, here's what happened, here are the major things that happened over the last 6 months with respect to the strategy, the customers, the users, the product. And so we give them a good, at least, conversational piece around what's happened, but we don't go too much into detail.
Where do you put it? What's the software that you use to keep track of?
We're just using Google Slides right now for that.
Just Google Slides. So yeah. If I come into your company as a new employee, I'm going to get a collection of Google Slides that I just click through that teaches me what's happened over the last couple of years at the company.
Yeah. So we have myself and Roxy, our office manager, and we go through those. There's two versions of it. And so we go through that story together with the new hires.
Oh, I see. I don't even have to read on my own. You guys will walk me through.
No, we take you through it and we make sure that it's there so that the right information is surfaced.
I'm imagining that one of the things that you put in there is pricing. Why is pricing how it is? No?
Pricing, I don't know that pricing's in there actually, our pricing strategy, but I think our pricing strategy does have a lot of room for conversation and growth, but
what would be in there? What's a topic that's in there?
Oh, wow. Where to begin? So something called IORs. So this is built around a book called Turn the Ship Around. And the book, I'm pretty sure your audience is familiar with.
I had dinner with the author of that book. Oh. And my job was to lead the dinner conversation. And I just kept leading it into like people's troubles in their lives. And at the end of the conversation, he said, one of the things I'm learning about you guys here in San Francisco is you're all very sad and troubled. I go, oh, I was trying to get into the personal. I swear we're not sad in person. We're not sad. All right. So sorry, what is it about Turn the Ship Around?
Well, they have this format that they use, and I sort of kind of customize it to ours, but I call it IORs. I guess if there's a similar version there, it's intention, options, results. And so we try to avoid asking for permission in our organization. So one of the things I teach people is that if you want to do something, you make your intention known as to why you want to do it, and you state what the results are and what options and trade-offs that you've assessed as to why this is the best way to go about it. So it's not like, hey, I want to go hire this person because I think it would be cool. It's like, no, you have to put together a structured, logical way. I don't want to be the person running the ship that everyone comes to permission to me for. I want to be able to make myself, in some sense, not obsolete, but more of a gut check towards the management team. And so that would be an example of how we try to foster certain levels of ways of communication in the organization.
I see. You know what? I could see how we could use that here at Mixergy. Yesterday, as I was driving to Napa where I wanted to work for the day, I got a text message from my assistant saying, this guest that we're considering is not a good fit. And she started listing all the reasons why. And I've said this a million times. Anyone at the company can actually say someone's not a good fit and just stop them. Kind of like the Toyota assembly line. Anyone can actually pull the cord and stop the assembly line and say, this piece is broken. Let's not send it out damaged. Right. And I think if we had some PowerPoint slide or something with all those, I don't know how, what do you call those things?
In this particular case, it's just management. It's management techniques or communication style that we have.
If we just had all those techniques down together, then you'd know it. Here's what we stand for, and we can go over it on a regular basis. We might need to do that
I think it's because it lives in the CEO's head. It lives in our heads, and we just know it intuitively. But then when you put it down in an email or a slide, and then you start talking about it, I remember our Michael. I'll never forget this because I use this example in the company meeting. I literally pasted a Slack message he wrote me, and it said, intention. I'd like to go to this event, and I'd like to do this, and this is the results, and this is the number of prospects we're going to hit. The results are going to be this on our leads, this is the conversion, and the opportunity, and then this is the trade-offs that we're making by not doing this because I won't be doing these things. And I'm sitting there, and I'm like, oh my God, I just have to say, my message was, sounds good. And he got the money to do it, but he didn't have to have a 20-minute meeting with me. He didn't have to get my ideas and feedback. He did the research. He told me what he wanted, why he wanted it, what the results were. And all of a sudden, I just said, if you want anything from me, like, you have to do it this way now.
You just have the ideal way done. And now you realize, okay, this is what everyone else wants. So if I want to, say, for example, get an office with a window, I'm going to have to tell you what we're losing, why I would do it. Or if I want to, let's come up with a more practical answer. Let's suppose I want to go work from Singapore. I just do the same thing. Here's what we're going to be losing by having me in Singapore. Here are the upsides of doing it. Here's what's required of you. Got it. I see. All right. Speaking of, by the way, one of the things that you mentioned earlier was that you guys don't all work from the same office. Why is that important to you?
Well, it was actually not by design, to be honest with you. One of our first key engineers wanted to stay in Waterloo, and he's too good to pass up. So we immediately split the company when we were four people, two in Toronto, two in KW. And so we were always, since we were a little bit older by this time, we'd recognized that it would make sense that the market is moving in a way where people should be trusted enough to be able to work from, if they're trusted enough to work from wherever they want to work for a reasonable amount of time. They can't just go 6 months and maybe take off to France. But if they need to spend a couple of weeks working from, you know, their house or whatnot, or working from their family's home that's abroad, we would be very much more ready communication-wise. We'd have the infrastructure to do that from a tools perspective, and people wouldn't be like, why does that person get to do it and I don't? And we didn't want to create that dynamic. And so what we did actually early on is we just said, let's all go do that. And so we took the whole team to Costa Rica, and we worked, there was eight of us at the time that worked from the jungle, actually, the rainforest, for a period of a month.
I see. And did you actually get work done when you're in a place with so little internet?
We made sure that was the first thing we did, was we actually got them to send screenshots of the speed tests. And we had multiple sources of speed tests that they sent it to us to make sure that we could work, because without internet, we would be in a very dire situation. But secondly, we got way more work done there for a couple of reasons. Number one, you wake up earlier when the sun gets you up earlier. Number two, I think since there was this kind of early remote culture, people that didn't get a chance to work together as much, we're now collaborating on projects that we had kind of brought forth to the table now that the whole team was there. And number three is we spent way more time doing some of those design projects that we needed to do. So there was so much more collaboration, and people had the sense of urgency just because this was sort of this catalyst for the year. So from my perspective, I think it was actually our best month for that quarter, in February, we had our best month. And so, you know, we didn't want to like start doing correlation and causation here, but everything really clicked. And I think people came away, and the most important thing out of all of this is that people came away really happy. People felt a sense of freedom. People felt a sense of control of their destiny with respect to where they worked, how they worked. And to me, that was really a fun experience for the team.
What's your revenue now, annual?
We are a private company, so we don't disclose that currently.
I know what it is. Can we say whether it's in the millions, hundreds of thousands, tens of millions? Can you say anything like that?
Yeah, it's between 2 and 10 million. So that's
between 2 and 10 million. You guys profitable?
We are not profitable, no, but that's by design. We very well could be if we chose to.
And one of the things that I saw on Product Hunt was a lot of people saying it costs too much. And you said, yes, you're not our customer. Your customer is who?
Our customer is the SMB and enterprise market, a product manager who exists in a team usually greater than 3 to 5. So companies under 50 employees, that want to create one roadmap every 3 months are simply on our starter package, and we do offer some, we do offer startup pricing to them, but nobody that's in the enterprise is, you know, Capital One or a big organization that's a bank is really going to balk at $600 a year. That's not going to scare them away on our business package, our enterprise package.
But the starter package for this is $19 per month.
Yeah, so $228 a year.
Okay. Oh, yeah, that's the annual plan that I was looking at. Got it. And then finally, our producer said, hey, I asked you a bunch of questions. I grilled you. I got your revenue. But you don't have to say it publicly. And then she said, all right, what did I not ask you? And you said, you didn't know about health. We didn't discuss that. Why is health so important for you to have brought up?
You know, for me, I have burnt out a few times, to say the least, in my life when being an entrepreneur and an employee as a product manager. And it really bothered me that everyone just keeps brushing this under the rug. You just got to put in 15-hour days. You've got to grind it out. That's what success looks like. And you know, you listen to even Steve Jobs online, and it's true. There, you got to put in hard work. There's nothing to say that you're not going to have a couple days a week that are going to be really pushy. But the sustainability of that for this, for your team's sake, for you being emotionally intelligent and healthy and present, requires making sure the balance in your life is there. So there's this four burner theory that talks about sort of the health, work, fans, and friends and family, and to be successful, you know, really successful, you need to cut away one of those, and to be crazy successful, you need to cut away two. And so for me, I don't fall into the second category where I'm just going to start cutting out health and cutting out family. I think it's important that there is a balance. So for me personally, what I do every day from at 3:30, I actually go to the gym. I set the tone that if the organization or someone wants to leave in the middle of the day for an hour to go to the gym, that's totally fine. There isn't a policy of ass and chair. We don't care about that. It's just something, and you know, I listen to a lot of Tim Ferriss as well, so I've picked up a lot of the healthy diets, I've picked up a lot of the routines, and when I put that in my life, I realize I can actually work longer hours, even though I take some time away to recharge in the middle of the day, but I get two halves of my day back. So I get this 9 to 3 at 100%, and then I get like 5 to 8. And I feel fresh at like 7:38. I can actually go out and do dinner, I can meet some friends. I don't feel like it's 6:30 drained because I just went all out for 10 hours straight. Mm-hmm. And I think if you want to be a sustainable CEO founder and have a lot of good energy in the organization, that's something that's just really critical for us. And so we, you know, pay everyone's gym memberships here. We cover a lot of the health costs because to me, that's how you build a long-term sustainable team that feels good about what they're doing at all times.
What's your workout? What do you do?
Oh, wow. I do a bunch of stuff. So I rock climb probably once or twice a week. I've been rock climbing for a few years, done a little bit of outdoor stuff. At the gym, I will do 2 days of weights, and then I will do 2 days of probably a mix of cardio and plyometrics, or yeah, plyometrics work. So it's a balance. It's not like college days where it's like 5 days of weights and 1 day off of carb loading and eating. That's, I don't do that anymore. So I try to stay more balanced with my approach there.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
Cool. And I am still looking at this product on page. A lot of people really like the design of it. What I admired was that when someone said, this doesn't make sense, how could it be so expensive? You came back in, you said, I know our product, I know our customers, here's why, and I'm not going to try to make you happy by changing the price for you. Makes sense. Congratulations on your success. The website for anyone who wants to check it out is roadmonk.com. And if you want to take advantage of any of the offers from our two sponsors, well, if you want to hire your first great developer or your next great developer, go check out toptal.com/mixergy. And if you want to learn how marketing automation could be made so easy that you actually will use all the features of your email software, go check out activecampaign.com/mixergy. I'm grateful to them for sponsoring. And Latif, it's good to have you on, man.
Thank you for having me, Andrew.
Cool. Thanks, everyone. Bye.